Hello and welcome, everyone. I am Jake Wurzak, and this is Masters of Moments. This podcast features conversations with the top entrepreneurs and business leaders around hospitality, real estate, investing, and company building. We explore the ideas, strategies, and approaches that brought them to where they are today. Hear the insights, behind-the-scenes secrets, and methods you can't find anywhere else. This podcast is for you if you are a seasoned investor, an upstart entrepreneur, or someone looking to break into the real estate and hospitality investing world. I would love to hear from you by tweeting me at @JWurzak on Twitter. And if you have enjoyed this show, I'd be incredibly grateful if you followed us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever podcast platform you listen to. We record on video, so you can always find all of our episodes on YouTube, and be sure to subscribe. Thank you so much for joining me and enjoy the show. My conversation today is with Isaac French, creator of Live Oak Lake and founder of Experiential Hospitality. This was such an awesome conversation because Isaac came out of nowhere to create a hotel in Waco, Texas, in a field surrounded by live oak trees and a cow pond. And then he created this whole business around it with a heavy influence on social media, didn't have a hospitality background, and it just stunned this little world of micro resorts. And he ended up selling the hotel for $1 million a key. So we talked about how Isaac came into hospitality, how he got his attention to detail, and why the focus is always on design and landscapes. We also talk about the sales process of Live Oak Lake, what he learned through that process, what he learned building Live Oak Lake, building the social media following. And we even dove into maybe what he's thinking about next and what he's most excited about in his upcoming travels. Please enjoy my conversation today with Isaac French. What I wanted to just start with is your background looks so good. Your new setup looks great. I'm a fan of your newsletter, and you talked about this thing called a nook. What did you build and where are you? And maybe we can just start there.
Yeah, cool. Well, first of all, Jake, thanks a lot for having me. I've been a huge fan and listened to basically every episode and have learned a ton. So it's a privilege to be on. I am in Texas, the heart of Texas, just outside of Waco. It's like an hour and a half north of Austin. And last summer, I got this inspiration to build kind of my dream office / studio, just like my dream space to be in and do work, get inspiration, create stuff. So drew up plans and built like a little 500 square foot, really modern Scandinavian, kind of married to Texas hill country, actually. Styled structure right on the edge of a creek, literally 100 feet behind my house. And I am an artist, so it has like a little art studio room where I can paint with really great natural light. It also has like a sleeping loft, so some of my VIP friends can come stay here. And then, of course, my office space and reading, a little reading nook and everything else. Yeah, I call it the nook. Seemed like a cozy place just to hang out and host other people and have good conversations in.
Well, it's good, kind of a good prologue to where we're going to go today, because when your office is branded, that gives people a little insight into who you are. Why did you feel the need to like create this little office space? You know, you're starting a business, you're an entrepreneur. I know actually when I was starting my company, I wanted to be in an office building because I thought that was what people do when they are starting a business. You got to be in an office building. You got to hang up your shingle. And now I want the opposite, actually. I want what you have. Why did you decide to do this?
That's a good question. Nobody has asked me that yet. I, first of all, wanted to be close to our home. My wife and I just had our first child last year. And so that's obviously my number one priority, is being a very present father and husband. And so that was number one. It's a beautiful piece of property that we live on as well. So it lent itself to it. But as far as the structure and like really going all out with this, and I haven't shared it publicly yet, like the background you're seeing is about as public as I've been with it. But the little bit you can see, like, I don't know, that attention to detail and perfectionism almost to a fault permeates pretty much every square foot of this place. And I kind of went overboard. I have a hard time doing anything halfway. And so this project was, it's supposed to be sort of a showcase of my favorite architectural features and has almost a little bit of like a boutique hotel feel when you walk inside, like the wall sconces, the finishes that we chose, the branding, everything. So I can bring people here and without giving them the speech, they can automatically feel what makes me tick and why I get excited about design and detailing and everything that went into this place. So really, yeah, creating a showcase for my favorite tastes in design and hospitality. And then of course, why not have the most inspiring place possible to work in? If I'm going to work, you know, why not do it in the absolute best place possible? So I feel really privileged with how it turned out. And I'm really excited to actually show more as we go along and host people. If you're ever in town, please come by. You'd love it too.
For a new entrepreneur, it actually, in my opinion, gives you kind of a position of power because it sets the tone, it sets the vibe. If you're going to have a meeting at your office without having to say a lot. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your generation and this generation of entrepreneurs coming up. A lot of people started businesses in 2020. How are they different from people maybe that you looked up to or that you've spoken to? And how are you thinking about building your business now moving forward?
Interesting question. I have a hard time comparing myself to the generation because there's a lot of things about my life that are intentionally very different. Let's just start with like my lifestyle. So this is background I haven't shared a lot publicly yet, but I grew up and was raised and actually still live in this intentional Christian community. It's agrarian. So we now have locations all over the world, but the kind of the main base is here in Texas. We have 500 acre farm. We farm with horses. We grow as much of our own food as possible. We have, you know, multiple generations. My wife's grandparents founded the community 50 years ago. And so my grandparents, her grandparents, our parents have all been here. And just as a quick plug, if I will, for that, I have to give credit where credit's due. I wouldn't be anything that I am today without the opportunities that were afforded me. I was homeschooled by two incredible parents, given opportunities to work in family businesses and with friends and build character in ways that are in startling contrast to a lot of the rest of the culture. And that credit, none of it goes to me. So my lifestyle is actually quite a bit different from my generation.
When you were setting out to build the space, how did you build it and where did you get inspiration from?
So 2.5 years ago, we built Live Oak Lake. I had gotten inspiration for that project from a lot of architecture from the Pacific Northwest, which is where I spent 10 years of my childhood. It's kind of the Scandinavian minimalist vibe, and which was very rare here in Central Texas. I think the design played a huge part in the success of that project. People weren't used to it here. It actually went together very well with the local landscape. And since then, I've realized my own tastes in design have evolved and there are new elements of textures and finishes that I have really taken a liking to. So this space was an opportunity to pull together my current, at least, palette of favorite finishes and design features. So we have, like I said, we're marrying this Scandinavian minimalist vibe, a lot of white oak, cabinetry, smooth natural finishes with things like brown Texas limestone, which is dry stacked, which you can't see in the background, but plays a prominent part in the exterior and the interior of this unit, and marrying together these seemingly disparate vibes that I think are really unique and go together well here. And the goal with all of it, especially on the exterior, was to blend into the natural landscape as much as possible, which is also a principle of landscape hotels, which is what I'm particularly passionate about. And this space, I think, does a really good job of that. It's a lot of shugi, bon, black vertical siding, a ton of glass, some of that stone, and a lot of trees in the landscape immediately adjacent to it. So again, trying to blend in and bring the nature that's literally 5 feet out the window from me inside. And we have a ton of plants inside as well, which is another great way to do that.
What's a landscape hotel?
A landscape hotel to me is a lodging facility or experience where the units are separate pods, separate units that are fully embedded in the landscape. So again, the focus is not necessarily the architectural uniqueness, though I think that can accentuate it. The focus is actually the landscape that you're immersed into. And then there's a lot of, I think, really compelling benefits that come along with that, because you can create this vibe of community, or like picture a village. What we did at Live Oak Lake, we had a 2-acre pond with multiple cabins situated around it. But at dusk or at sunrise, you have all these amazing lights outside that reflect in the water. And you just have this feeling like you're in this really charming European village. And you can do that with the landscape hotel because you have these separate units that are spaced out, affording some level of privacy and seclusion because you have topographical features and trees and all of that. But then you also have that, again, that communal sense, which is where the hotel part comes in.
How do you blend the architecture with the landscape? And maybe you can talk about that in the context of what you did at Live Oak Lake.
Yeah, so let me preface that by saying here where we are in Central Texas, I'll be the first to admit, is not the paragon of natural beauty. And I have come to appreciate the unique aspects that we do have, such as these live oak trees. So in my opinion, they're some of the most beautiful trees in the world. They get massive. They're kind of the flagship tree of the South. And we have a ton of them here right in my backyard and where Live Oak Lake is, which is 5 minutes down the road. And when we bought that property, it had a small, like a cow pond on it, which we were able to dig out and turn into this quaint lake. And so the dream was, let's actually show off to Texans, because that's our target market here with Live Oak Lake in the Texas Triangle region, people in the 2-hour drivable distance. Let's show off to them how beautiful this place is while also transporting them into a vibe, so to speak, that they're not used to. So that's where we brought in these European elements. So they're almost like A-frames, but they're not A-frames, super steep pitch roofs, tons of glass, and then a virtually black exterior, which black, funny enough, is the best color to blend into a landscape, especially in a forest setting. So I would have thought, well, maybe it's green or brown. Black is actually the best because it just recedes into the shadow. And so all of those cabins are nestled in the trees. And we very, very specifically, deliberately chose those locations to nestle them and leave appropriately enough trees around them, plant more trees back. So the black, the finishes are the shugi bon siding I was mentioning before, that just gives a little bit of warmth because you see some of the brown earth tones come through the burned look. And then a lot of black standing seam metal. So it's super clean lines. There's literally no eave the way that we did it. So they're 25 foot long panels that are hand creased to match the edge line of where the eave would typically be. And so again, the objective is just to make it recede as much as possible into behind the trees. And then from the inside, you're looking through all this glass. And so you feel completely immersed in the space. There's skylights, trees inside as well. So yeah, I think black exteriors and adding in elements of warmth like that shugi bon, or in this case with the nook, we have that limestone dry stacked in like the entryway. And that ties in perfectly to just the visual cues of like the boulders in the kind of the shelves of rock that you see outside, which is endemic to the Texas Hill Country region.
How did you find yourself in the hospitality business?
Well, I like to say, it sounds cliche, but the hospitality business definitely found me. I did not seek this. So I mentioned a little bit about my childhood. I grew up very entrepreneurial from a young age. I had every number of businesses you can imagine from the time I was 6 years old on, and have always been a left brain and right brain kind of person. So took up accounting in high school and tax prep, which was a great business foundation. And then was also an artist and always loved design. Wanted to be an architect at one point. So studied design. And then my dad had a construction company, which I worked in. That was really the primary occupation I've ever had as far as like a job. I had other jobs. Like I made cheese at one point. A lot of people don't know that. I made artisan cheeses when I was a teenager for like 4 years. And learning construction was, it came obviously very naturally, very relationally, because my dad had the business. I could grow up alongside my older brothers and learn the ropes, became a project superintendent, a project manager on decent sized commercial projects when I was 19 years old. Again, an opportunity that most people don't have because they don't have the relationship there that allowed the trust. So that was awesome. And then just learned, yeah, the construction trade inside out. And that naturally led to a love and a curiosity for real estate. I always assumed real estate was obviously, you know, the best place to park and grow money in the most passive sense possible. Being now where I'm at in the hospitality industry, the passive part I can probably take away as a qualifier, but started doing some projects with my dad, actually like helped him. We bought a fourplex and I refurbed that and, you know, re-tenanted it and sort of turned it around. So got my feet wet with long-term rentals. And then he was actually getting into a few Airbnbs himself a few years ago, actually did a really cool project, which was featured in the Magnolia TV show called Restoration Road. He took an old train car. So it was like a 150-year-old train car that was totally dilapidated, infested with cats, you know, basically rotting into the ground, and moved it to this piece of property he owned in Idaho, beautiful countryside views, and built sort of like a depot style structure around it, though it's just really an awning. So it's open air, totally refurbished the train car and brought it back to its original glory. And it is truly glorious. And so that was a cool project to be involved in. That was in 2020, really during the pandemic. We worked on that. And he launched that project, did a couple other small Airbnbs in the area. This was in Idaho. And then I moved down to Texas around that time. And that's where I started really thinking about what can I do with my construction skill set? Instead of just going to work for another general contractor, I am very independently motivated and, again, very curious, so always wanting to push myself. I was just thinking about how could I bring together all the interests that I have, sort of work for myself, figure out something entirely new. And that led to this idea, which had sort of been brewing under the surface for a few years in retrospect, of creating this property, which was a small village. I didn't know anything like this even existed. You know, it's becoming a huge trend now, and I know of a ton of other properties that even were existing at the time. So I was by no means original with it, but had this idea to create like 7 cabins, 5 to 10 cabins that were very uniquely designed, extremely high end, extreme attention to detail, cohesion throughout the whole property, immersive as possible, create a following around that and market it as this landscape hotel, though I didn't have the term at that point. And so, yeah, in a nutshell, the story with Live Oak Lake was early 2021, started looking for property, and one morning was scrolling through Zillow. And sure enough, you know, 5 hours previously, this little plot of land had been listed for sale. Went and looked at it. It checked all the boxes. Most importantly, it just sort of viscerally connected with me immediately. When I walked on the property, I literally got goosebumps. I felt like this was the place. This was the context to sort of manifest that dream. So made an offer on it, was accepted 9.5 months later, and a ton of hard work and lessons learned, bootstrapped all of it with, brought in my dad and a couple brothers who lent me the money, the equity that I needed to qualify for a construction loan, also co-guaranteed the construction loan with me. and built this property out. So we opened the doors in January 2022, and I haven't looked back since then. It's been a whirlwind as far as the success that we've had with it. It just blew all of us away. But I've also fallen in love with the practice of hospitality, with, you know, hosting people, connecting with people, providing people with these experiences that they take away for their lifetime, these memories, these traditions that they've created around that property. And the doors have just flung open in front of me. And it's been a little overwhelming, honestly, how much opportunity there's been since then. But yeah, it's very multidisciplinary. As you know, you're bringing together the design element, the construction element. You've got to raise money, get financing. Then you've got the marketing element. You've got operations and automation and the systemization mindset. All of these pieces were so fun to bring together because though I had all these different experiences, I'd never done, besides construction, any of these particular things that I'm doing now with that property. So that property was the fertile soil for the seed that was inside of me to sprout and hopefully continue growing. But yeah, I've really fallen in love with hospitality. It's like the most fun thing I've ever done. I couldn't think of a better opportunity to invest my talents and grow new ones than hospitality, specifically experiential hospitality.
It's one of the few businesses that combine a true operating business with real estate, where the real estate is so impactful to the operating business. But in addition to that, the operator has to work so hard to create those moments, those memories, and those experiences. How much of this did you have figured out when you were looking on Zillow and trying to find this property? Like, how much of the plan was there and then you found the land to then, you know, do that plan? Or how much of it came about once you found the land?
So it's a funny story. There was a piece of property which is literally like 1,000 yards down the road from where Live Oak Lake is today. Same road, literally like a quarter or half a mile down the road, that a friend of mine owned, like a 15-acre property. And it was a totally different kind of property than Live Oak Lake. It had some trees, but it was the primary draw was it was on this bluff, like a 50-foot bluff next to a dry creek, which was interesting too. So I was like, the idea was happening before I knew about that property. But when I saw the property, I'm an opportunist. And I was like, what could we do with this? If I was ever to get my hands on this, I was thinking this to myself, what could you create? And somewhere in there, it started gelling like, oh, short-term rentals, because those are going to be the most lucrative form of real estate and also the best suited to showcase something like this really cool natural feature. So I started just slowly trying to convince this friend of mine to sell me that part of his property because he wasn't doing anything with it. And he was warming to the idea and we had agreed sort of to a general timeline. And then it just was taking forever. And I was like, man, this is going to take probably 2 years for me to actually be able to do this. So in the meantime, that's when I was starting to look on Zillow and was like, what else is around here that would be maybe just totally different, but that I could start on tomorrow? Because like, I felt highly motivated. I had gotten married in October of 2020, had moved to Texas just months before that, was starting a new life, was looking for, you know, obviously my next career opportunity. What am I going to do? Had considered going to work for other people, was considering a lot of different things. And this idea had just sort of slowly, the pieces of it had been coming into place for a long time, though I didn't realize it. And really, until I walked onto that piece of property that we ended up buying and turning into Live Oak Lake, I don't know. I don't think that was the moment where it all clicked. Like at that point, I was still coming. I went to tour that property sort of as a real estate opportunist. Like, what could we do with this place? In the back of my mind, thinking maybe it's these cabins or whatever. When I walked on that place, which, don't get me wrong, was a total jungle. Like, I had driven by that property. I mean, I grew up here probably 50 times, never thought a thing of it. Just looked like a bunch of greenbriars and trees, poison ivy. And when I walked on it and saw that little lake, saw the live oaks that were like these hidden gems within it, I don't know, it all came together. So yeah, it's, you never can predict what's going to happen. You just have to be ready to jump on opportunities when they come up. Another person ended up buying that other place. And in retrospect, my idea would not have been very well suited to that. There would have been all kinds of liability issues. It would have been hard to create kind of that communal vibe that you get at Live Oak Lake because they're nestled around the lake. So yeah, that just shows how good chance is sometimes at upending our plans and giving us new, really exciting opportunities that we couldn't have ever predicted.
How do you think about the location, meaning like the location on a map and the beauty of the site? Because from a location standpoint, there's no real draw in Waco, right? I mean, there's maybe a little town, there's some restaurants, but I think people are staying there on the site. So as you go to look at other sites now that Live Oak Lake has been successful, how do you think about the location, meaning the town, the city, what's around it?
Yeah, so in full disclosure, Waco does have, it over the last 10 years, has seen quite an uptick in tourism. Magnolia, Chip and Joanna's little empire, is here in Waco, and that draws a surprising amount of people. You'd be shocked. A very certain demographic. But no, you're right. I mean, it's not the prettiest place. There's not that much going on here. But what it does have going on, and I was cognizant of this on some level when I chose this. For one, I mean, it was in my backyard again, so I just got lucky with that. But the biggest factor, I think, when choosing a market, especially looking back, is what is your proximity to bottled up population bases that maybe are even very affluent that are lacking those experiences that even, you know, you certainly have abounding in Florida. And Texas is just, I mean, it checks the boxes. We have 21 million people in a 3-hour radius of where I live. And there's a very high GDP in that area. There's a lot of money represented there, but the whole state is fairly hungry and lacking in beautiful places or fun things that are truly, you know, like all season activities, stuff like that. So outdoor themed things especially. So being in Waco, we're literally right in the center. We're like the hub in the wheel of those cities. And that 2-hour distance, 2 to 2.5 hour mark, is very important, I think, because that is totally doable as a staycation distance. You know, you can pick up and go on a 3-day trip with hardly any planning, just sort of spontaneously. And Texas is also a really big state. So it usually takes a long time to get out of the state to go somewhere cool. So the experience that we designed at Live Oak Lake, it wasn't Amangiri. It wasn't the Four Seasons. It's, you know, $500 average ADR a night. So it's definitely higher than just a Holiday Inn Express, but it's very affordable. So there's a lot of middle-class families that are coming out. Middle-class families and like romantic couples getaways are kind of the two main demographics. But that being said, we also are uniquely suited to host this wide spectrum of guests. So, I mean, we have weddings and corporate retreats and family reunions, small events at least, because we can host, you know, 40 people on the property. We have a lot of folks that come through, especially in the post-COVID era of work from anywhere, you know, remote travel. We have super fast Wi-Fi, which is one of the really important basic amenities that you would think other places should have too, just by paying extra to have fiber brought on site. So a lot of people come and work there and they're doing it. It's kind of what Wander is tapping into. They're doing it from this beautiful place, but that's also tech enabled. And so, yeah, I would say the most important factor is being in that localized travel region where it's easily attainable to get in your car and drive 2 hours. And there's a lot of other markets across the Midwest, across the Southeast, that would fall into a similar category. They're just overlooked. And I think that is a prime opportunity for other entrepreneurs to go and create these experiential first, design first properties that cater to those that do showcase a sense of place, that can find a unique way to show what is beautiful about that area, create something unique about it, bring a theme together, and then, yeah, build a brand around it and reap the profits.
We're going to talk about that. My experience in hospitality is very high touch, high service. How much do you need to engineer experiences, meaning like create activities for people versus just create a beautiful place and let them do whatever they want, but on a very basic level? Like, did you find a need to, I got to have a yoga class every day, I got to have a painting class every day? Or do you just set a beautiful setting and people will figure out on their own what to do?
I think there can definitely be a spectrum of how much involvement you as the host, you as the hotel need to have in that. And of course, opportunities to partner with other local vendors that can, you know, lead some of these experiences and such. With Live Oak Lake, and I think we have found a very high amount of success and a sweet spot there in being very low touch. So we give them the basic ingredients. And let me say this. I actually got this from the book Unreasonable Hospitality, which I just read, and it's just an amazing book. I think Will says something in there to the effect of the whole idea, and he's talking about restaurants, but of course it applies here, is that you're trying to create an environment where service and accommodations are the ingredients in the recipe of human connection. So the whole idea is we want people to come and reconnect with themselves, reconnect with nature, spend time as families. We intentionally do not have TVs in any of the units. We have very fast Wi-Fi, so that's obviously, it does the job. But we don't want people to come and hole up and, you know, whatever, play video games. Yeah, if they want to do that, that's fine. But we're going to encourage them to interact with each other and interact with the outdoors. So we have kayaking on the lake. We have walking trails throughout. We have, of course, fire pits and little s'more kits. And we upsell some different packages for, because we have so many like couples getaways that are slightly interactive, but, you know, cakes and balloons and different activities that couples can do that are just so small. You'd be surprised at how far a little can go when there's thought put into it in terms of experiences, even like the welcoming experience for the guests. So yeah, we don't have, one of the reasons we're so profitable is we're so efficient. Like, it is extremely low touch, highly automated. We'll talk about that, but the welcome gift, they walk inside. I realized, I just had this intuition early on that people love to see their name handwritten. So I kind of developed this little process and then trained the staff, and they handwrite a simple card to every guest that comes there. And people love that. When they walk inside, they see their name handwritten. It's next to a plate of fresh cookies that was literally baked that day by the bakery right down the street. And little things like that even offer some level of experience. Experience is a wide spectrum. So yeah, you could engineer it to the point of, I've stayed at Amangiri, and you know, they have all kinds of, you know, tour guide experience guides that can come along and facilitate all manner of things. I mean, you're going to pay thousands of dollars for some of that stuff, but I don't think you have to do too much, at least in the price point that we're targeting. I think you just have to offer a beautiful location, put thoughtfulness and true care and authenticity into the delivery of it through things like the welcome gift I described, and yeah, encourage them to spend time with each other. I think anecdotally, we probably see about 50% of the guests that actually go into town and maybe go to a museum or go to the Homestead Craft Village, which is where I live, or go to Magnolia or wherever. There are a couple touristy kind of things, but you'd be surprised at how many of them literally just come, especially families. They just love to come and hunker down, and the kids can run all throughout the property. It's fenced and gated 24/7, so it feels very secure. And those are the best kind of spontaneous moments that people have sometimes, just sitting by the waters, relaxing in the hammock, watching their kids paddle on the lake. So that's my opinion. I'm certainly open to the idea of engineering it further, but I don't think that it's necessarily essential if you have a beautiful property and can put those different ingredients into it.
While you were building Live Oak Lake, what were you most concerned about, and what did you focus on to overcome that and turn it into this very successful investment?
I was most concerned that people were actually going to show up. It was a big risk for me. I was 24 years old, and it ended up costing us $2.3 million. My budget was like $1.5 million. And so thankfully I had some family members.
Well, you passed the first hotelier test. You went over budget on your project.
Yeah, but I mean, it really was a big risk. I'd never done anything like that. And I was just like, are people really going to like it? I mean, I believe they would, but there was nothing like that. And there still isn't in our market. And a lot of friends that are in short-term rentals, especially, were definitely dubious of the idea. Like, man, you are overspending for everything that you're doing. But again, there were just compromises I was not willing to make in those details to craft that overall experience that I could envision these guests having. I think liability was another thing. I don't know. I was just, when you've never done it before, I was like, because I knew early on that direct bookings were going to be a big emphasis at some point for us. I didn't realize it was going to happen as fast as it did. And so I was like, I mean, we've got a lake, we've got a lot of kids coming, we've got these spiral staircases in the cabins. There's just a lot of things that could go wrong. And I waffled on, you know, and considered a lot of different ways to mitigate that with waivers and agreements and all these different things. Ended up throwing pretty much all of that out. We have a container pool, we have hot tubs, and we've never had an incident. I think that, you know, you can satisfy most of the liability stuff with some simple insurance, which we have. It costs $5,000-$7,000 a year for the whole property. That, frankly, is one of the biggest concerns I've had from other people since sort of telling the story, and other people have seen the success that are curious about short-term rentals and specifically direct bookings is, hey, you know, Airbnb provides this amazing insurance. Aren't you terrified that something wrong is going to happen? Or just guests damaging something. We actually have more control. We're the ones charging the guests. So if there's an issue, first of all, there's a security deposit, but we can also just literally charge their credit card if something goes wrong. And thankfully, we've never had any issues like that. So those were my two biggest things, but thankfully, neither of them really panned out.
Well, you keep talking about short-term rentals, but what you build and what you're doing is really not short-term rentals. And I think one of the ways it's not is how you got people to show up. How did you get people to drive to this little place? And how did they even find out about it?
Yeah, that's a funny point too. That's an interesting point. And I've thought about it recently. The first thing you said, which was, is this like how, what is the identity crisis I'm dealing with? Is this a short-term rental? Is this a hotel? Is this somewhere in between? Initially, I definitely thought of it as a short-term rental because that was my framework for approaching hospitality. I never even considered a hotel as a, you know, viable option. Since then, I'm much more identified with a hotel, though it's somewhere in between. A landscape hotel or micro resort is a good term for that. Because, of course, I don't have to say it properly, but you're bringing, the idea is that you're bringing the best of both worlds. You're marrying the personalization and boutiqueness of the short-term rental, the charm of the short-term rental, with some of the systemization and the communal aspect and the brand of the hotel. So as far as how we did that, it all started because we got kicked off of Airbnb. And that was the biggest scare of the whole process, construction, owning it, everything. Like 2 weeks after we opened, well, first of all, when we finished construction, I don't know, I didn't do any marketing in advance and I didn't try to book any of the rooms before we were done. I was just so consumed with, you know, getting it over the finish line. And I was literally wearing every hat in the project. I subcontracted some of the construction work out, but I was literally there 80 hours a week figuring it all out. And then I realized, like, oh boy, we got to the end of the punch list. And I realized, oh my, we're about to open and we are paying interest on a note and we don't have any guests and we're starting from zero. So that was the first heart attack moment. We got on Airbnb and they prioritized your listing like the first month that you're open to give you some traction. So we were starting to get bookings. I had some of my friends book. They, of course, paid for their stays. But some way or another, the algorithm that Airbnb has flagged us as a, you know, possible whatever fraud, that we were faking reviews, which of course never happened. And so we literally got kicked off, and Airbnb customer service is absolutely abominable. It's terrible. Could not get a hold of anyone for days. And in that process, I talked to this person, actually your guest, Ben Wolf, he knows her as well, but she reached out to me. Her name is Amanda Spencer. She had a couple travel accounts on Instagram in Texas. I didn't even know what a travel account was. And she was like, hey, I should do a promotion on your place when you get it up and running. And so we actually scheduled that, but she was months out booked. And so I called her. I was like, look, this is where we're at. Is there anything we can do on Instagram in the meantime to get the word out there? And she was like, well, you could try such and such and such and such. Hey, talk to these people, see if they'll do a giveaway. So I could just cold DM'd this account and in Dallas that had like 100,000 followers at the time. Dallasites 101 is their handle, and got in touch with them. And they're like, yeah, pay us $900 and send us pictures because we don't have time to come out and we'll run a giveaway post on you. So I did that. And literally within 2 days of all this happening, they ran the giveaway. We got 5,000 followers overnight. Well, over about 7 days, but most of them like in the first day. And like $40,000 of direct bookings just came flooding in. That happened. And then another incident, like a week later, another account, which was big on TikTok, same kind of deal, like a Texas travel influencer who's looking for, you know, unique places to show their following. He found us too. He was like, hey, this is cool. You know, there's nothing like this. This stand, I haven't seen this before. I should just run a reel on you or a video, whatever it is. So we didn't even do a giveaway on that one. That one like went mega viral, got 1 million views in like a couple days and just inundated us with bookings. So my life went from like the absolute dregs of like, oh my goodness, here we go. We're ruined 2 weeks into this. We got kicked off of Airbnb. We built our house on their land and now they won't let us rent it, figuratively, to being like, oh my goodness, this is the jackpot. And then I realized in that little incident, those two incidents, that our brand needed to be the number one focus. Yes, we needed to actually deliver the experience, which was fairly simple. Again, going back to what we're doing, because once you figure out the basic principles of that, it's simply training the team to do it. And there was plenty of mistakes there and lessons learned along the way. So I went all in with these travel influencers and I hired like 30 of them in the first 6 months. And probably 60% of them had virtually no results. So I ended up spending, you know, $10,000-$15,000 that just went down the drain. But I also learned a ton. Some of it was really basic. Like you can tell when they have a really big following, but their engagement is really low on the posts, they probably have a purchased following, at least in part. And some of that had happened. And then also I learned as far as like which influencers you wanted in what niche you wanted to work with, because somebody with 1 million followers that's a health and fitness guru is not necessarily who we're after, though they have this massive following. And I learned that the hard way a couple times. But there was a sweet spot of like these Texas travel influencers. So they literally are just looking for restaurants and hotels or Airbnbs that are unique and in this drivable distance from these big cities. A lot of them are based in these big cities, Houston, Dallas, Fort Worth, Austin, San Antonio. So went all in with that. And in 6 months, grew 50,000 followers from scratch. I mean, supercharged our bookings. It was also the perfect opportunity to do that because we obviously had a lot of occupancy starting out from scratch. So I could give away a lot of nights to these folks when they came and stayed there. And then even those that didn't deliver on the giveaways or getting bookings created content that we were able to use. So great learning experience. That endeavor of creating the brand was the most valuable thing I did. But in terms of the entire project, because of even how it was valued when we were acquired, but that would have only been as good as the property was. So actually creating this experiential one of one kind of destination was the most important thing, obviously. And that's the hardest thing because you can't cut corners when it comes to crafting that, going back to what I was saying about not making those compromises with every design decision, with everything that went into crafting the property to where people walk on site, they drive in the front gate and they literally have that moment where they're like, where am I? I do not feel like I'm in Texas. And people tell us that all the time. That's the best compliment I ever get. It's like, I feel like I'm in a different world. I've never been to Disney, but it's that sort of concept of offering a transportive kind of experience where people feel totally immersed in something.
As you start to get into the flow of Live Oak Lake and you're seeing some of your competitors and you're really starting to think about the business, what do you think you did really well that your competitors were missing? or other people you saw in the space were missing, whether they were in Texas or anywhere else in the country?
I would pin it back to the unwillingness to compromise. I hate to beat the drum on that again, but you see so many properties. I could go through Airbnb, I could go through Instagram, and there's a lot more that I look up to now that are online, and that were on, some that were online that I just didn't know about at the time that certainly don't fit in this category. But it's like so many people, either they just don't have the vision for what it takes to create that kind of wow factor, to create those one of a kind Instagrammable moments, which is another reason it succeeded so well. This was also the user generated content that just took off because people see all these incredible, and we intentionally framed it. So every cabin faces a certain direction that is sort of framing the canvas of what they're experiencing, the view, the trees, the lake, the container pool, which just blends perfectly in and is so cohesively tied together, all these Instagrammable moments, but all of those were carefully thought through. And I think so many people just don't have the vision. They get excited about it. They can appreciate it, but they don't know what it takes to create that. And it's really hard for me to articulate because I'm not saying I'm special. There are certainly people a lot better at this than I am, but it just comes very intuitively to me. It's like, I don't know, it's being an artist, I think, having that artistic mindset of what can we create here? What can we imagine and envision? Which was really what I was engaging in from that first moment I stepped on the property before we purchased it, of like, I could feel this is what the property could be someday. So being able to see what it was. And then as we went through the process, obviously we had to make a lot of adjustments to that and iterate on it. And it got, I think it turned out even better than I was initially planning. But to see that all the way through is just really, really difficult. And my hat is off to those that can pull that together. But, you know, we didn't hire architects and interior designers and really anyone. I mean, we didn't hire engineers, architects, and thankfully we didn't have to from a building perspective because we were in an unincorporated part of the county. But also from a design perspective, we took a huge risk with all that, but it all worked. So I know it's not the most novel answer, and I've already said it before, but just being able to pull together all of these different details that really do add up to that magical experience.
So let's talk about the numbers of Live Oak Lake, because I think the big objection to what you did is this is a one-hit wonder. Isaac was able to do it because it's in his backyard. He was there. He's very hands-on. He's very creative. But it's not scalable. It's going to be hard to replicate. And how do you make money with only 7 units? So can you kind of break down for people how successful this thing really was and just give us kind of the numbers and the recap, both on the investment side and on the operations of the hotel?
Yeah, so we spent overall $2.3 million, including soft cost financing costs to build it. Again, I think that was under the market cost for sure. We didn't have a general contractor fee tagged on, nor architects or consultants or anything like that. And the first 12 months of operation, we grossed $960,000 and we net before debt service $520,000 on seven doors. We built our following to roughly 75,000 people in that first 12 months. And we averaged 92% occupancy. Then we ended up selling about 9 months after that first year. But the T12, when we sold, was $1,050,000 top line, $630,000 EBITDA. And we sold for $7 million. So we sold for $1 million a key to the dollar. And our following was 150,000. The buyers told me that they valued the, and so if you do, first of all, if you do the cap rate calc on that, it's not unreasonable. It's just over 8. So we're very profitable, but most of the value you could say was created by building that brand. They said that the email list and primarily the social media following of over 140,000 people at the time to them was worth several million. they put a number on it, but it was very high. So yeah, the value creation in a super short amount of time, if you can pull all these pieces together and especially build a brand around it, is just off the charts.
Most real estate investors, I've never sold a hotel for $1 million. Okay. And most of my friends in the industry haven't. But I got to tell you, a lot of people would have said, even from the start, if they thought and they looked at this from a hotel lens, $2.3 million, you know, you're building 7 units, it's too high price per key. And then you tell me your margins. If you would have said, hey, I'm going to be doing $80,000 a key in NOI, I'd say, no way, you're crazy. Some of the best hotels in the country, the highest hotels in the country don't do that. So did you even underwrite any of this when you started? Or was it very basic? Like, how did you even think about it? Because from a hospitality perspective, everyone would have told you you were crazy.
Thankfully, my operations and cash flow underwriting was as conservative and under what it should have been as my cost. So we went like, you know, 500,000 plus over budget, but which is like 30% of the project. But we also totally just blew past every expectation for both occupancy and ADR. I was underwriting for, well, let me think here. I was underwriting for like $175 a night ADR with 75% occupancy, and the numbers worked. Another way that we convinced the bank to even give us the loan, because let me just make a note here. I think this is obvious to you and a lot of other people, but traditional lenders do not understand this asset class, if you will. And I think that's part of it. It's not really viewed as an asset class. They couldn't figure out from an appraisal standpoint how to classify this property. Is it a campground? Is it glamping? Is it a hotel? What is it? So I didn't do the best job communicating. I mean, literally, I prepared like a numbers sheet that took me like an hour to throw together. I'd never seen a pro forma, an underwriting model. I'd never seen anything that I gave them. So I don't blame them too bad, but I got turned down also by other banks. But yeah, they lent the money. Thankfully, it would have only been possible because of, it was only possible because my dad and brothers had this line of credit that they had access to. And I gave them equity in exchange to get us over the finish line. But when we refinanced 4 months after construction was complete, so we didn't even have close to a full year of operating experience under our belt, the same appraiser, same commercial appraiser came out the second time and reappraised the property at $3.1 million. So double, like almost double their initial appraisal, which resulted in us getting a loan, refinancing. And this was a good move because interest rates took off right after we did this. It was like June of 22. We refinanced 5.5%, pulled out, paid off the construction loan, the line of credit, everybody's equity, everything, and like $400,000 in excess of that, and locked it in for on a 20-year 5% loan. So then, you know, like I say, a year after that, we sold for more than twice the second appraisal amount, which is just insane. It's mind-blowing to me as well. I think, you know, I definitely think those initial appraisals were low. But what I learned through all that is, and I'm going to try this. I'm curious your thoughts on this. A friend recommended this to me who does like multifamily, but hiring an MAI designated appraiser, finding out who the bank uses and hiring that appraiser yourself as the developer proactively, and then basically presenting that to the bank when once you get sort of the initial approval that they're going to lend, and making them reconcile whatever their numbers to yours. Because I just realized the appraiser is so subjected to who their client is, whether that's the bank, who's obviously going to be extremely conservative, or me as the developer. So yeah, you're going to maybe spend an extra, what, $5,000 to $20,000, at least on the kind of projects I'm talking about, to do that. It's not cheap to get an appraisal. But if it could result in an extra, you know, $500,000 of equity that I don't have to give away to somebody else or financing, my goodness, that's worth it. Do you think that's feasible?
Well, banks are always going to order their own appraisal. And a lot of the bigger banks They don't even know what appraisal company is going to get it. You know, they bid it out to three. They have an appraisal department. With smaller banks, you might be able to give them the appraisal and help them guide to a number and allow the loan officer to direct the appraiser maybe how to think about the project. But, you know, you actually gave me an idea. A mentor of mine, Dean Adler, of Lupert Adler Partners, is incredible with numbers and an incredible real estate investor. And during the pandemic, we were talking and he said, you know, it's so hard to get a hotel financed, but if you have a furnished apartment, they're going to look at it on a basis of an apartment. Sure, it's furnished and they're going to adjust their rental rates accordingly, but they're going to look at it as an apartment. And maybe an option for you on your next project or others in your space is to not finance this as a hotel, but finance it as little vacation homes. And if you decide to change the business plan, then you can do that and maybe not sell them and maybe let the project run its course. Or maybe the strategy might be to run it as a vacation project and eventually sell off individual units to people. So you're still kind of going with that theme. But that could be a strategy where you're financing it as a different asset class, because you're right. The asset class really doesn't exist. And it's being formed now. And there's not a lot of comps to it. I mean, you know, your comp exists. You would show that to a lender. That's amazing for your track record. But I think another thing that is incredibly unique is the margins you're able to drive. So you're doing 60% margins. What's the secret to that?
Two things: price optimization, revenue management. And that is a extremely in-depth, complex topic. And I'm certainly not the foremost expert on that, but I have learned a lot along the way. Basically, let me summarize it in my view by saying this. A lot of the big brands, like let's take Four Seasons, for example, they're maybe operating a 100-key hotel. That'd probably actually be on the lower end of what they have. And they're also a global brand. They have a certain expectation. People have a certain expectation of what they're getting, obviously, when they book that, what they're going to pay. And so they won't drop below what I would say are really, really outrageously high. Now, I think they're worth it, but prices, let's say that's $1,500, maybe it's $1,000, I don't know. They won't drop below that because they're worried about a precedent, presumably. Like, they don't want other people to then, they don't want the entire market to erode underneath them because they were willing to do that. Even though I bet they're, you know, I have no idea, I'm totally speculating, but their break-even cost is substantially lower than that. And with Live Oak Lake, a 7-unit property, I was willing to come down to a much lower threshold. Now, you do have to obviously have a threshold because you don't want just anyone coming and staying there, let alone operating costs. And for us, that threshold was like $275 a night, all in. We don't go below that. If we do, we see an 80-20 diminishment in the kind of guests we get and the damage they do to the property. But our cost is like maybe half of that. It depends on how occupied we are, but just to use rough numbers. And so we said that is the lowest benchmark. And then we go up to, we've booked nights for over $2,000 a night and peak weekends with, you know, an event going on in our city, or like the upcoming total solar eclipse is a huge one. Like, that one's going to go off the charts with how much everybody can get from that if you're in the path of totality. So you see this wide spectrum of prices. And in general, a weeknight is going to be, you know, $400, and a weekend is going to be $600. So there's actually a pretty big differential between weekends and weeknights. But allowing that kind of dynamicism in the range allows us to have 95% occupancy. Now, we never want to hit 100%, obviously, because then it probably means we're undercharging. But we're really, really happy riding that 95%. Overall, averaging $515 a night. Obviously, the numbers, that's part of the contributing factor there. The other one is efficiency and systemization. So, I mean, this is becoming kind of old news because a lot of people are starting to utilize a lot of tools like this. And I assume maybe the hotel industry was doing this a long time before Airbnbs and short-term rentals, but we have a software stack. So of course we have a property management software, which aggregates all the listings. So we can be on Airbnb, VRBO, booking.com, all the OTAs. And then it also provides our booking engine. So we built a really beautiful website on top of their booking engine infrastructure with Stripe as the payment processor. And then we have tons of smart home technology. So we've got, of course, door locks, lighting, thermostats, noise monitors. Those are the main ones that are all tied in. So there's another software that sits in between called Operto, but basically you have all of these hardware components in the units that are talking directly with the property management software. So for instance, a guest books a stay, it automatically assigns them a unique door code. So there's obviously contactless check-in for us. There's no process that we're involved in there. Sends out an automated message. Messaging is obviously automated through the PMS, which I put a lot of care into detailing and personalizing those messages so they don't sound transactional. They seem very personal. And also just developing the right amount of communication, because you can go in either ditch there. A unique door code goes out to the hardware. The thermostat gets pre-programmed to adjust automatically to our range. The lighting, same thing. So we create this little bubble for the guest experience that is just unique to them, which saves us energy costs, because when we have a vacancy or just even during the turnover, during the cleaning, the temperature will adjust accordingly. And we save 20-25% energy costs with that. We obviously save a ton, though, just in human resources, in not having to have somebody, a full-time hotel staff that you would normally have, even with a smaller property. So essentially, I systemized it all the way down to a general manager / guest communications, which is about 10 hours a week, seriously, remotely done for $500 a week. And then a part-time maintenance guy who is like $1,000 a week, because there's a lot to keep up with a property like that. So we're like $1,500 in people costs, and then another per week, and then another, let's just call it, you know, $800 if we're using week, which is a funny interval here, software costs. So very, very, very minimal, but it does the job. The cleaners are, of course, piecework. We have a little laundry facility on site, which is appealing to them. They're all subcontractors, but they don't have to leave the property. We have commercial washing machine, dryer, extra storage, all of that. They can do it right there. We pay them $100 per clean. They're extremely happy because that's above the going average around here for Airbnb cleaners. And that general manager / guest communications person does quality control checks over there every now and again. She also gets paid a piecework fee to set up the guest experiences, which are the romance package, the birthday experience, which are very high margin. We charge $200 for those. They cost us $100 after paying this person $50. It takes her 20 minutes to set it up. So there's just a ton of efficiency baked in. And that all is, I know it probably sounds funny because like from a hotel perspective, it's just apples to oranges. It's like, where do you even start to draw comparisons? But, and so that, you know, the downside to all of that is with my current model, if you were to scale a portfolio of properties like that, then you would start to have some overhead infrastructure that comes into place. But there's a lot of wiggle room to pay for that. And the model still stands pretty well to afford that. But yeah, if you're just a one-off investor and you want to have a property like this, show me another asset class or investment opportunity of any kind where you're going to find a return close to that.
It's tremendous. So let's talk about the return. Okay. You built up 150,000 followers. You built this beautiful brand. You built a beautiful property. It's down the street from your house. Your life is optimized. Everyone loves you. And you decide to sell it and walk away. What's the story of the sale of Live Oak Lake?
Yeah. So when we built it, I dreamed all along through the process that, you know, this was going to be a legacy property. I didn't even know if I would do others, but this would be a huge part of my life for the rest of my life, that property. I was partly right and partly wrong. It has become a huge part of my life, and I think will continue to be that. But that property we sold, and that was a long time coming, actually. So it's always been my personal philosophy that you shouldn't get emotionally attached to material things, including real estate. Now, maybe there are exceptions like some family homestead or family property, but in terms of like investments. And a lot of people were like, oh, you'd be crazy if you ever even thought about selling that. You know, never sell that. It's you captured lightning in a bottle, and it go on and on and on about the reasons not to. But I was like, look, if we get the right price and the timing is right with the overall market and if the stars align, why wouldn't I? Just being open to the idea. And then sure enough, you know, we started operating it. Everything has gone tremendously well. Like there has been nothing. The things that went wrong ended up being the catalyst for what went right, hence the Airbnb story, to this huge degree. So the press, the operations, the profitability, the reputation, everything has just been tremendous. And I started just feeling intuitively like, and after talking with my family and close friends, we should consider putting this on the market and just seeing, because I've had so much interest. When I started telling the story on Twitter primarily in 2022 after we opened, I was just inundated with all of these different people that wanted to invest, mostly like mom and pop operators that wanted to level up their Airbnb portfolio or whatever. But then a lot of actual like high net worth or institutional. So like I was approached by numerous private equity shops that wanted to buy a majority stake. And I realized through all of that, after a lot of conversations, it was primarily a talent play. They wanted to buy 70%. They wanted to retain me, sign a contract, and then basically have me build them this portfolio. And it was tempting. They have deep pockets. I don't have to worry about banks, which was like the worst part of building the whole thing. Just dealing with the lender and convincing them and that whole terrible process. I hate it. I'm like, well, at least we could solve that. But I just didn't feel like it was the right thing for me. Like, again, I'm very independently motivated and really appreciate a certain level of autonomy that I didn't think I was going to have. So turn those things down. And then I was like, well, maybe we should just list it and see what happens. So we listed it for $6 million because the number that I was originally pegging was $5 million. I was like, $5 million would be such a home run. I mean, no one's going to pay that. But if we could get that, my goodness, I'd sell it. So then I talked to this commercial broker, and he was, after he saw the numbers, and he was like, oh my, what is this place? He was like, you should list this thing for $6 million. And he was kind of looking at traditional cap rates in other asset classes and was like, man, $6 million is a steal for somebody, actually. Yeah, I mean, totally. And I was like, what? You think we could get that? And so we listed it and had some interest, but nobody was serious. We took the listing down. That was the end of 2022. And then January of last year, a broker in my area reached out and was like, hey, I know that you listed this place. I know it didn't sell, but look, this is my wheelhouse. I am in experiential hospitality. I sell, you know, restaurants to everything from restaurants to marinas to high-end hotels all over the country. I live 15 minutes away. This is a perfect opportunity. Let me list this for you. So his timing was really good. We worked together well. We listed it in spring of 2023. And very quickly, we had tons of showings, much, much better listing and overall experience. We had somebody give us a contract. First, they tried to lowball us. They're like $4 or $5 million. And let me clarify, when we relisted, we went to 7.3. So I was like, look, we're really going to put this out of reach so that if it's meant to be, then somebody better be willing to really put some money up here. So we had somebody offer us, finally, they offered us 6.5. We got them up to, and I was like, look, I'm going to take that. Interest rates were skyrocketing. Nobody knows what's going on in hospitality and the overall economy. It's early 2023. We signed the contract, go through due diligence, everything checks out. And then the day before we're supposed to close, we get on a call that was like supposed to be celebratory. Like, look, we did it. And look, I learned so much through this process. Again, like, just the selling part was a masterclass in real estate transactions. We get through and the buyer tells us, we had a little hiccup and the hard money lender isn't quite ready to close tomorrow. Give us a couple extra days. And the biggest lesson I learned through that is they only had $15,000 of earnest money down, which is ridiculously low. I'd already spent at least that much just with my attorney. And then sure enough, in like the next 2 days, the entire deal fell through. Their hard money lender had actually backed out weeks before and they hadn't told us. They were as green as I was from a buying perspective and me from a selling. And so, yeah, everything, the listing expired with the agent. And then like 4 days later, we get an LOI from this other group for $7 million, $500,000 higher than the first offer. They originally wanted us to sell or carry a portion of it. And so we got in some talks with them and felt like we could work together and struck a deal, $7 million with a partial, like a $1 million seller carry note through the end of the year. This guy had access to a lot of high net worth capital and an institutional background. So very well connected. Due diligence checked out. They put $200,000 of earnest money down this time. So we were fully covered there. And then the closing comes and the closing goes and they can't close. They had an investor back out. They had another investor back out. It's like, oh my goodness. Well, at least we have 200,000. So we ended up signing like an extension. And then the next deadline came and went. And I was like, this is ridiculous. All right, one more time. We're going to give them you one extra week. And they got their act together. And the last final day possible, they finally were able to close. And so by that point, I was like, exhausted from the process, was super relieved. Think we both did well with it. The property is operating as efficiently and profitably as it ever has. So I'm happy for them. And I feel really relieved. It's a huge, honestly, a weight off my shoulders. Like, I love the property. It will always be my baby. It's how I fell in love with hospitality. I think it's a great resume builder for me with whatever's next. But it was the right time, the right place. And I have no regrets with it. So yeah, it was a big decision. That was a long story that you didn't ask for, but I learned a ton through the process.
I love this story. What are you going to do differently now? Now that you've had this experience, you've built it, you've created something, you've sold it, you're not just sitting around doing nothing. What are you thinking about and what's different about that strategy and approach now?
I'm definitely not sitting around doing nothing. I've been connecting with tons of folks and helping out with everything from coaching to a masterclass and now a community similar to yours. A lot of other folks in the space that are building properties like these. And so that, for one, has been super eye-opening to see the options that are out there, really. And there's nothing like really feeling pushed by peers that are operating at the same level or higher than you are. So that's actually one of the selfish reasons I actually built the community, because I wanted to have that personally. There are a lot of people building cool properties right now. And part of me, like at the current moment, is almost starting to feel tempted to have some sort of FOMO of like, oh, I've got to get back in the game immediately. I'm hoping to do a 1031 exchange on that. So defer a ton of taxes through that. So I do have some deadlines to hit and locating the next deal. As far as approach, I think the single biggest opportunity I missed, and I don't regret it, it was learning, but is telling the story as I went through the building process. So yeah, now I already have built up a small following in the space around this, but it is storytelling gold to craft a property like that, from the concept to the design to the construction to hosting, every aspect of it. So as important as the story is to make it to the guest experience, because story is, we didn't talk about this a lot, but crafting a narrative for people and sort of selling them the story about themselves when they come and visit, which is like marketing 101, as important as that is to the overall guest experience, it's equally important to the development process and getting more attention in the space from more investors and snowballing that aspect and jumpstarting the bookings and the overall hype around the property. So I look forward to telling that story as we go, documenting it through video. I'm considering YouTube. I mean, it's such a visual undertaking you're crafting these high-end, beautiful, unique, nature immersive hospitality experiences. I mean, it's like the perfect thing to video. But YouTube is, speaking of a channel, is really hard, and I haven't committed to that specifically. It's like a treadmill. You have to keep producing, and you got to invest heavily in that if you're going to take it seriously and grow. But at least through short form content, just like, and I think that's the biggest opportunity and the lowest hanging fruit, because I have a friend, Devin Lowrop. So he built a shipping container, look this up, called the Pacific Bin, B-I-N, a shipping container home in the woods of Washington State. It's 5 shipping containers that he designed. He's an engineer by trade and did the entire thing himself and documented it through iPhone videos that he spliced together, did a bunch of like time lapses and before and afters, which are super engaging, documented it on Instagram and grew a following of 800,000 people in 1 year with like 140 videos in this process. When he opened the doors last year, when he was done with the project, he booked out a year in like 2 weeks or something like crazy like that. Now he's doing the second cool stay on his property. Same thing. Now he's going all in with YouTube. So that's just a brilliant content play. He's building up this massive following, which also can be valuable from an investor's point of view, if he's going to go raise money and actually really scale that idea. But he's also baking in this huge amount of guest demand in advance while he's doing it. And literally he did it with a $25 tripod from Amazon and his iPhone. That's it. So telling the story is the biggest opportunity as you go.
So I have kids. There's a show on Disney Plus about, I think he was like a film producer or something in his family. They moved to California to revitalize a farm that just was dead. And I'll find it and send it to you. We'll put it in the show notes. But they filmed this beautiful recreation and rebuilding of the farm. And the storytelling is amazing. I actually think stuff like this is probably more impactful on YouTube, although you can find it on Disney Plus and it looks beautiful in an hour. But I think it's more immersive being on YouTube.
Are you talking about, is it called The Biggest Little Farm?
Yes.
Yeah, that's amazing.
I think that's what it's called.
It's gone
crazy. It's amazing.
So that was, and he was a filmmaker by trade. So it was like perfect for him. Came in, but it was like, this is the lifestyle we're seeking. So I may as well document it as I go. But nothing about it was recreated or like superficial. It was their process of taking it from, transforming it from what it was, which was, you know, completely destroyed by commodity agriculture that had happened before them, to what it became. And that's a phenomenon. Literally, my dad and my brother just went there like a couple weeks ago for like a workshop.
Really?
Because they're into regenerative agriculture.
That's so awesome.
Perfect example.
So the best hospitality experiences I've had are transportive and they create a fantasy. It's like your imaginary life that you get to experience for this little amount of time. And they can live life through you because everyone wants to be doing something magical, and building experiences always look magical. But when the thing is completed, the best hotels I've been to feel like a fantasy in every way, from the design, the landscape, how you're made to feel, the smell, the sound, all the sensory moments. What would you do differently from the size standpoint? Like, is it bigger? Is it smaller? What would you do differently from experiences and amenities? Like, are you going to have a working farm, maybe, given your background?
Should I give away all my secret plans?
Well, we didn't talk. So if I just like gave away your
plans. No, you're good. You're good. You're good. So no, I haven't said much about what the next thing is as far as the specifics of it. We've talked about approach and different things there, but I think that what's called agritourism, which is, speaking of the biggest little farm, perfect example, I think that's a really compelling opportunity right now. And yes, given my background and my lifestyle, that is the lowest hanging fruit personally for me. There's nothing like that around here. There's a place, you may know this, in South Africa called Babylon Storen. Have you ever heard of that, Jake? you got to check this place out. It's insane. It's a funny name. Babylon Store, in one word. And it is this incredible Western Cape Dutch styled farm / winery. They've got two farm to fork restaurants. They have a small hotel and like cottages on site. But it's this immersive experience for people. They're actually growing every bit of food that you eat in the restaurant. You are literally staying in a cottage feet away from where that food is grown. It is absolutely meticulously and immaculately designed. World class. And they have tourism from all over the world. They've created a massive brand around it. I don't think there's anything. It's hard to top that. But that is a really cool idea, I think. And I have not shared this at all publicly. I can't believe no one's doing that here in the US. There's like a place called Blackberry Farm in Tennessee, which is cool. But no one is operating anywhere close to Babylon Store, in my opinion. We're actually going to stay there next month. So I'm really excited about that. But I would love to create a farm setting with the most beautifully designed landscaping. Let me just say a word about that. And you probably, actually, I've seen your posts on Twitter, so I already know that you agree with me. Landscaping is the highest ROI investment you can make in a hospitality investment. It's literally, the way I look at it, a 5x ROI. If, you know, it's five times, let's just say it's five times more valuable than the structures in terms of the dollars spent. Because that is so key to what you're talking about, creating that fantasy, creating that feeling, creating the vibe, the ambiance, whatever you want to call it. When I think of experiential hospitality, I can't divorce that from a natural setting of some kind. And so part of that can be the beauty that's already, a big part of that can be the beauty that's just intrinsic to the land, sort of like a sculpture that you're, you know, crafting by removing all the things that are not, all the negative spaces around it, like we did with Live Oak Lake. But then there's an element where you can actually tastefully inject onto that landscape and create this incredible feeling. I think those are the most magical moments you can create, is when you bring together, let's just imagine a, you know, perfectly manicured lawn and small flower garden within this rugged landscape of forest and mountains and whatever as a backdrop, and you marry those two things together. So I think there's an opportunity to do that with some kind of a farm stay. Babylon Store is the best example of that. Speaking of, if you look it up, there's like these incredible mountains and just rugged terrain all around it. And then you have this incredible landscape design and hardscaping, stonework that's been put into it, pathways, mystery throughout, you know, fun little spaces to go and explore. And so bringing that level of design to a farm setting, and then embedding lodging units and say a restaurant within that, would be a pretty cool dream. But now I've literally given away, it's my secret. So nobody go build that.
It's incredibly hard to execute. So giving it, well, I mean, it's kind of funny because I don't know, we're on the same wavelength. Literally, I was just thinking that. And then, you know, I don't know.
Well, it's uniquely suited
with you, I guess.
It's uniquely suited to the community. So we have several hundred thousand people a year actually coming through Homestead. It's called Homestead Heritage, to visit, because we have a craft village. So we have a blacksmith shop. We, like I said, we grow a lot of our own food, but we work with our hands. So we have craftspeople that, you know, do every kind of craft imaginable. So fiber arts to blacksmithing to woodworking to a coffee roastery to the farm to table restaurant. And so we already have that component, but, and we also have the people. So like, this is another big question. A lot of people are like, how do you hire? And I already told you, I'm hardly hiring with, say, Live Oak Lake, though the people that are there are very important. You can't diminish that. But if you're going to have, say, like a farm stay, like I just described, you're going to need a lot more people. That's much more intensive. You've got full-time gardeners and landscapers and, of course, the housekeeping, management, maintenance, and then the F&B part, that's a whole nother dimension, which, to be honest, intimidates me more than anything, because I've never had a desire to nor been involved with running a restaurant, and I know they're hard.
The restaurant might be the easiest part to sort out and figure out, although integrating it is going to be challenging. But the people and the margins and the cost, I think, is going to be your challenge. Another place, Stone Barns in New York is a agricultural immersive restaurant, and I believe they have hotel rooms there as well. And it's, you know, award-winning, unbelievable. And there's some places in Napa Valley that I think don't have as much agriculture, but there's the wine thing going on. There's some good reference points, but I don't want to go to California. Honestly, it's too far away. I'd much rather go to Texas. So I think the opportunity for you in that space is huge. And you mentioned Blackberry Farm. What Blackberry Farm created is, you know, Live Oak Lake times 10, because you created this little brand that someone wanted to buy that had incredible value. But Blackberry Farm created a place where people wanted to live at and buy homes. They even have dogs. Did you know you could buy a Blackberry Farm dog? I mean, that is peak Isaac branding when you're selling dogs from the hotel. So I think using them as a North Star is really cool. And what they've also done is now done a spinoff where they have Blackberry Mountain now. And, you know, those are things that
they also just bought a town called Wyndham in New York. They bought like half the town, I hear, and they bought the little ski mountain there and are totally transforming that place too. Because I have a friend that owns a place in Wyndham and he was giving me the inside scoop. So they are going places. But yeah, incredible brand. I want to go stay there. I've never been to Blackberry Farm.
I think a lot of the best ideas and concepts in hospitality have actually came from people with not a traditional hospitality background. You know, you think of Ian Schrager, who came from the nightclub business and invented the idea of boutique hotels. Barry Sternlicht, who came from a real estate finance background, did One Hotels and W Hotels, created the, you know, the W, the Heavenly Bed at Westin and all this stuff. Can you point to any examples where you, looking back on what you did at Live Oak Lake and what you're thinking about now in the future, where being naive or unexperienced in hospitality was actually an advantage for you because it allowed you to think about it in a different way than maybe me coming and trying to do what you did?
I think having the fresh perspective that if we build it, they'll come. If we spend the money, they'll come. And believing in that vision of like what we're creating, not being constrained by a, you know, some kind of framework of, well, you never spend more than this per key, which is what a lot of the Airbnb investors that I was talking to that I'm friends with were telling me. Those constraints, or, you know, the branding, I don't know, a lot of people thought that I was kind of going off the rails by this idea of trying to emphasize direct bookings and creating this brand and all of that. I don't know, it just felt like, why not? You're, instead of giving 17% away between what the guest and the host pay to Airbnb, that's pure profit. If you can find a way to capture that, and you can then remarket to those guests and create a lifetime relationship with them. So I'm not trying to claim that I was the pioneer of direct bookings, but Live Oak Lake certainly helped catalyze the entire movement around direct bookings and the idea that you can build a brand, the idea that you can use Instagram to sell directly to the guests and create the relationship right there with no middleman. And having no prior history with hosting as on Airbnb or being in hospitality definitely didn't hurt me when it came to thinking that through and being open to experimenting, even with the marketing approach in general. I think if I had to define it with one word from start to finish, I would just say it's been a lot of experimentation. I have tried all kinds of different things, bringing in YouTubers that aren't necessarily in the travel industry. I mentioned how important it is to find these local travel bloggers for Instagram, but then I brought in people like Shelby Church. She has a 1.5 plus million followers on YouTube, and she's like more of a general influencer and, you know, lifestyle. She came in and did a video that has got, that has been viewed 1.5 million times. It's a 15-minute video. That certainly impacted us. Cody Sanchez, another sort of like business personality that sort of came in and did a behind the scenes interview. That video has over 1 million views. So again, you know, being unafraid to knock on these doors, whether it's a YouTuber or the Instagram thing or the email list. And I feel like there's still a lot more to learn there and utilize with emails. I think that that's even one step better than Instagram because you own the audience and you can never be deplatformed even from Instagram, nor do you see any dilution as you grow, or at least it's very marginal. Like with Instagram, we saw certain engagement rates around, you know, 20, 30,000. I would say that was kind of the peak area of percentage engagement. The ratio of people that were following us, the ratio that we're engaging of those that were following, I should say. As you grow, that gets diluted. And so now at 150,000 plus, maybe we only see 2 or 3x the same engagement, but we have, you know, 10x the following, whatever. Those are just things that happen with social media. It's not something to complain about. It's still way better than Instagram, but now we're pushing emails. So there's just so many aspects of marketing in general, and you have to be willing to experiment, be open-minded, try things. If they don't work, no problem. You learn from that. And that has served me very, very well. And I am really grateful that I didn't have the inhibitions that would have naturally come from sort of being steeped in the industry.
Isaac, I ask all the guests on the podcast the same closing question, and that's, what's your favorite hotel? And I'm going to come back and ask you in 3 years what that is, because that's going to change, I'm sure.
That is going to change because I have traveled not nearly as much as I wish. That's about to change very quickly. But so far, by 1,000 miles, my favorite experience has been Amangiri. I invested heavily just to stay one night there. It cost over $6,000 last spring. We were driving on a road trip back from visiting family in Idaho back through Utah. I have never, going back to our conversation there about creating that element of like fantasy, I've never experienced anything like that. The whole place, I had done my research before I went there, and the whole place literally over-delivered and blew away my expectations in a way that's impossible to quantify. We also went at like the peak time of year. It was, I think, April. The weather was gorgeous. The sunsets were amazing. We just stayed one night. The food was like the best food I've ever had. The entire place is complimentary after you spend that much money. But it was sensory overload. The sounds of running water, the little private pool, the orchard lined walkway with the details, the attention to detail, it was like singing through my entire body the whole way, because I can appreciate all those things. I mean, talk about opening up the horizons of what's possible. So far, Amangiri by a mile, but I look forward to a ton of other places, some of which you recommended to me offline the other day.
And I look forward to staying at your next hotel. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you very much. It's been a fun time talking, and I really do look up to you and feel like I learn new things from you every week through your tweets and through the podcast. So thanks for doing this.
Hey everyone, it's Jake here. Thanks again for joining me on this conversation. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. Lastly, don't forget to follow me on Twitter at Jay Wurzak. I'll see you in the next episode.
Jake Wurzak is the founder and CEO of Dove Hill Capital Management. All opinions expressed by Jake and his guests are solely their own and do not reflect the opinions of Dove Hill Capital Management. This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not reflect or represent real estate, financial, or investment advice.